and welcome to Celebrating Cinema, a podcast for the love of cinema. I'm your host, Laura Romans, and I'm here with Lab 111's head of cinema, Tom Ooms.
Hello there.
In the time span of 6 months, we're getting two Frankenstein-related movies. October last year saw the release of Guillermo del Toro's Frankenstein, starring Jacob Elordi and Oscar Isaac. And this month we get Maggie Gyllenhaal's The Bride! With Jesse Buckley as the titular bride and Christian Bale as Frankenstein's monster. Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, or The Modern Prometheus, has become the third most adapted book in history. And every screen adaptation is a bit of a Frankenstein's monster itself. Over the decades, we've seen the monster be terrifying, tragic, funny, and even romantic. In this episode, we'll take a look at some different Frankenstein movies, and if there ever has been one that didn't low-key suck. Here are some cool things going on at Lab 111 in Amsterdam. Seeing as The Bride is the first theatrical Frankenstein movie made by a woman, make sure to check out some other films that are part of our Female Frame series to mark the week of International Women's Day. Check out our full program at lab111.nl. Also, if you like what we do, please leave us a review on your favorite podcast platform so we can be found by other film fans like yourself. So Tom, today we're going to be talking about a little bit of history, which is one of those episodes where basically I tell you about the history of Frankenstein and you're going to try and derail the episode constantly.
That's me.
Just so the listener knows what they're in for. So first, I kind of want to go all the way back in time to the creation of the book. Because it was kind of created on a dare, Mary Shelley was 18 years old. She was going to go on vacation with her husband and Lord Byron and a bunch of other people. And the weather sucked. So Lord Byron was like, hello, what if we all try and create a fantastical tale about like supernatural things? They all wrote a little something and Mary Shelley absolutely ate them all up because Frankenstein is, I think, kind of the only one from that trip that made it out. Correct me if I'm wrong. So she wrote Frankenstein. It initially wasn't published under her name because it wasn't, you know, subject matter that was suitable for a lady.
But of course.
So first it was published anonymously with an intro by Percy Shelley, her husband. And only in the second edition in 1823 was it revealed that Mary Shelley was the writer. There's actually a movie from 2017 about Mary Shelley straight up called Mary Shelley. It stars Elle Fanning. I don't know if you, have you ever seen that one? I never saw it. Because I read the Wikipedia kind of synopsis, and it seems to be mostly just about her relationship with Percy. And I'm like, do more Frankenstein. Do more Frankenstein stuff. I don't know.
Elle Fanning?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah, I feel like she kind of has that kind of...
No.
She has that.
I could see her do that. And like the opposite. I thought maybe I should know in this film.
Let us know if we should see this movie. So this is the 1800s, so her story is heavily inspired by the Enlightenment science and ongoing debates about medical science and anatomy. So her novel is about Victor Frankenstein, a young scientist who assembles a living being from all kinds of dead body parts and animates it through the power of science.
The power of science!
Science! In her story, the monster is not inherently evil, but he becomes violent after Victor abandons him. And all the movies kind of have those themes, but they heavily alter the motivations and the characters and the framing devices and the messages. So let's take it back to the beginning of film history. This is a fun one. It's the Thomas Edison Company one in 1910. It's one of those like 12-minute long silent films. You can watch it on YouTube. And it's funny because this movie was created before we had like the visual language of Frankenstein. That came later with the Universal ones in 1931. So this is just like the monster is just like an ugly guy kind of.
You mean he doesn't have the bolts? And
yeah,
the,
he doesn't have like the yeah. He looks more like what
he doesn't
we would,
look like Boris Karloff, which is just
wow.
Like,
yeah, exactly.
Yeah. We'll get to that.
He kind of looks more like we would imagine Quasimodo or something from
right.
Like it's just like an ugly dude. It's quite fun.
Hey, a little respect for Quasimodo.
What? Yeah. He's cute.
Yeah.
There's a really fun stop motion thing when the creation happens, like the really old, mm-hmm. like 1910s kind of like assembling boop, these boop, pictures. Boop, 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 boop. It's yeah. very fun. But yeah, the visual language of what we think of now as Frankenstein came in 1931.
It does include the whole pulling the switch, and or is that all from the 31 movie?
No,
like the,
I mean
the you know the bolts of lightning and stuff like that, and the
well, it was very limited because it was a silent movie, so it's kind of just like a painted decor. I think he has like a skeleton, if I remember correctly, has a skeleton that kind of has a. It looks like a puppet theater, like a Punch and Judy style, like puppet theater, and you just see the monster kind of assemble, in stop motion, which is pretty cute. But yeah, as you mentioned, the visual language that we have for Frankenstein with the bolts and the square head and the flat head and the heavy eyelids, that is all Boris Karloff and the Universal one from 1931. What's funny is that the look of Frankenstein has been kind of decided by that movie, but in the book, he's kind of hot. Like in the book, Frankenstein is supposed to be this like perfect human because he kind of assembled.
In the book, he's played by Jacob Elordi.
He's really tall. No, actually, he is. In the book, he is described as being 8 foot tall, so Jacob Elordi. So what it says in the book is his limbs were in proportion. I had selected his features as beautiful. Beautiful, great God. His yellow skin scarcely covered the work of muscles and arteries beneath. His hair was a lustrous black and was flowing. His teeth of pearly white. But these luxuriances only formed a more horrid contrast with watery eyes that seemed almost the same color as the dun white sockets in which they were set. So it's very like, I don't know.
What the fuck is the final part of that sentence?
It was like, he was kind of hot, but his eyes were weird.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know exactly what the deal is with that. But yeah, I think if we look at how Frankenstein has been portrayed throughout the years, I got to say, maybe the Guillermo del Toro one with Jacob Elordi is the one that gets kind of closest because he does have.
But this, because this, I mean, sounds pretty damn romantic in the sense that he's this made up human idealized version of like a dead put together assembled man.
Yeah.
Do you know why he then becomes an ugly?
I mean, I think it is more fun to portray it that way. And I think it's the way it's described in the book is weird. It's like, so he was gorgeous and beautiful and had gorgeous teeth and gorgeous hair, but his eyes were hollow and weird.
Right.
And his skin was yellow and weird. And it's just like, I don't know how in the Universal Monster era they came up with the look of Frankenstein.
The idea of Frankenstein is that he is this, that you feel some pity for him, right?
Yeah.
Would you feel pity for like
Jacob Elordi?
Jacob, specifically Jacob. There are situations. No, but this doesn't gel with something that could also be just a bit sentimental, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I could understand that you would then make him more
make him
of a, like,
to make it make sense that he is this, lumpy, like, tragic figure
exactly,
that gets
yeah,
rejected
yeah.
by, is like, oh my yeah. God, what did I do? Because, like, if
yeah,
I...
pretty people
no
are
offense,
tragic.
If I created Jacob Elordi, I wouldn't be like, what have I done? I'd be like, hey, we gotta, it is what it is. And, you know, it happened and we can't really do anything about it now. And that's what my truth would be.
Is this Weird
way.
Science 2 starring Laura Gomans and Jacob Elordi? Oh no, I created Jacob Elordi.
Again. Fuck. White boy of the month again.
But his eyes are weirdly in his sockets. But he's hot.
That is kind of true. That is kind of true. So yeah, I think the monster look really fits with the theme more, and it makes it more cinematic maybe to put that on film instead of kind of a regular looking guy with weird eyes.
Yeah.
And yeah, so in the Universal version, the monster becomes really tragic. He's feared and hunted and misunderstood. And he is quite like childlike and looking for companionship. And that companion comes in the form of the Bride of Frankenstein in 1935, which is going to be the blueprint for Maggie Gyllenhaal's movie, which is out this month.
Mm-hmm.
So the Bride was never really a part of the book. In this movie, it's basically the monster asking Victor Frankenstein's like, hey, what? Like, everyone on this earth has a mate. Am I supposed to be alone forever? What's this all about? Can you create a companion for me? And then Victor Frankenstein kind of goes, hey, you make a good point. Why not? You know, I'm going to create this bride for you. And then he again does it. And then he goes, wait a minute. What if they procreate? That would be bad. Whereas I think if you're the creator of this monster, maybe you're a little bit in control of whether or not they procreate, but could be me. I don't know science, and I'm not a doctor, and Victor Frankenstein is. So he kind of just goes, hey, no bride, no thank you. And then the monster gets pissed and he's like, I'll see you on your wedding night. He shows up at Victor Frankenstein's wedding night and he kills his bride, Elizabeth. So the movie version is a bit different because it's Dr. Frankenstein and some other doctor who says, hey, if we don't create this bride together, I'm going to report you to whatever the medical association is for whatever shit you've been doing. So let's create this bride. So yeah, they go about creating this bride. It has another one of those really cool creation scenes that's like the lightning strikes. She wakes up and the monster approaches her and she kind of goes, no, gross, what? So that is kind of...
He should have looked like in the book. You know?
Yeah.
Maybe she would have been attracted to him. Yeah.
Who knows? But yeah, she gets the universal one, so I get it. And the bride, of course, has this really iconic look, which is a very often replicated as a Halloween costume with the beehive hairdo with the like lightning-shaped white stripes. Excellent Halloween costume. And as far as I understand, because I haven't seen the bride yet, but as far as I understand, Maggie Gyllenhaal's The Bride kind of takes this concept and completely turns it around into
She even gives it more layers because the film itself, not to spoil anything, because, well, when this podcast will come out, everybody probably watching it already. The thing is that what she does, she uses Mary Shelley, as also portrayed by Jesse Buckley, as a ghost that takes over the body of the bride before she gets resurrected. So there is this weird interplay between the ghost of Mary Shelley, the individual that is the body of that will become the bride of Frankenstein, mm-hmm. and this sort of constant battle between Mary Shelley, who talks through her mouth with a British accent, and then she moves back to an American accent when the real person... with Jesse Buckley. Are you still following me here?
No, not at all. Like, this sounds complicated as hell.
Before she becomes the bride, before she literally in the film says, I am the bride.
Yes.
Of course,
bride in time. Yeah,
of course, that's what she says.
Before she says her famous line, it's bride in time.
It's bride in time. She's a girl in 1930s America, New York, like sort of moving between these rich guys and some mobster types, and she gets possessed by the ghost of Mary Shelley.
Wait, what? Okay,
yeah. And then she dies, and then Frankenstein, the already resurrected Frankenstein, like the Boris Karloff Frankenstein, but then played by Christian Bale, asks a doctor to give him a mate. So she...
Wait. You know what this reminds me of? This reminds me of, like, you know when there's, like, episodes of Gilmore Girls and there's, like, they're watching a movie that an actor is in, but that actor also exists in the world of Gilmore Girls?
Yeah.
How is Mary Shelley a real person in this universe if she's the person that wrote the story and Frankenstein? Like, I don't...
Yeah.
I'm going to have to see it. I'm having a hard time following how that would be a thing.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Cool. Anyway, as I gather, she does a very different thing with it than The Bride of Frankenstein.
Yeah, but there are a lot of things that do very much resemble also the whole, you know, the specific parts of both the original Frankenstein and the Bride sequel, as she would call it. All those things are there, but she just give it some sort of new perspective. It sometimes reminded me of Poor Things, for instance.
Right.
Also in the look of it. I mean, Poor Things itself is also
set in the 1930s, clearly. And it kind of looks, from the trailer at least, looks like it has kind of like a Bonnie and Clyde-y vibe to it.
Yeah, and there's this, they become sort of this natural born killers vibe, a duo on the lam. You know, on the lamb.
On the lamb.
On the lamb.
On the lamb.
And she becomes, because during her resurrection, you would say, she...
It looks kind of Metropolis-y in the way that
That's the 30s. Yeah. That's kind of the 30s look. She gets this sort of smear of what is it? I think it's...
Poop, I think.
Poop.
Continue.
I think it's ash. And it sticks to her face, and that becomes this symbol of later in the film for her of this sort of group of women who are also trying to rebel against the patriarchy, because they are killing people, and that's of course incredibly inspiring for a feminist movement.
We love to see it. Anyway, The Bride is going to be screening at Lab 111. Let's continue to go back into time. Hi, we'd love to hear from you. We're currently running a quick survey about the podcast so we can constantly keep improving what works, what doesn't, what should we talk about. We have 100 euros worth of prizes, including merch, vouchers, and posters for 5 lucky entries to say thanks for giving your opinion. You can find a link to the survey in the show notes. So we're going to go back to the 50s and the 60s, and here we go again, Hammer Horror. We've heard about them before with our good friend Christopher Lee. For those who haven't listened to our episode about the history of vampires, we've definitely seen these guys before. Hammer Horror was a British film studio known for kind of reinventing classic horror, but now they were in color. So now they could show blood that was red, and they were camp as hell and way more violent and sexual.
Still a bit orange, though.
A bit orangey. Yeah, it's like their whole thing is like now in vivid red. And it's like, well, if you look at it now, it kind of like...
Exactly, yeah.
Have you heard of laser projection, dude? For the time, it was quite innovative. So the Hammer version has Peter Cushing as Frankenstein and Christopher Lee as the creature. And it's very clear about the fact that Victor Frankes is the true monster. He was driven by ego and a lust for power, which kind of reflects the post-World War II trauma and Cold War anxiety. There's a lot of unethical behavior from people in power. That was a big theme, as you can imagine. Science without morality, unchecked ambition. That was kind of what the Hammer Horror ones were about.
Which one is this?
Which one is this?
What is this called? Is this... Because there are so many of these films. Oh, it's this one. Okay, sorry. I'm an old man looking stuff up on a computer as well. The Revenge of Frankenstein. We dare you to see it. We double dare you to forget it. Okay, I guess.
I love it. Yeah.
That's super nice. What I find amazing is that there is these different iterations of usually the person that plays Frankenstein and then portrays it for like 15 years. There are, I think, maybe 8 films with Boris Karloff playing Frankenstein.
Yeah.
But then also Lon Chaney coming in as the werewolf, I think. So they are doing these overlaps of the Universal horror things. Horror monsters.
Well, this is something that we've talked about
as well
before in the Vampires one. Is like, we always think that the MCU kind of thing is
That's
a new
I mean.
Thing.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
It was so happening back in the day where it's like, here's this Universal monster and he's going to come play with this Universal monster. Brr, 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 brr. We're going to make 700 movies.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's the same thing you mentioned Christopher Lee. It's like, okay, yeah. How many times did Peter Cushing and Christopher Lee portray Dracula and Van Helsing? And
I mean, they were working.
Yeah.
They were clocking in for their shift at the Dracula factory.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
No, I just find that amazing. Every time people always whine about, oh my God, we're in the world of constant
slop,
returning IPs, but it used to be better. No, some things used to be better, but we were doing that same shit.
Yeah, we had
well.
A phase where we weren't doing that, and that's the phase that we were all born in, and then we're like, it never used to be like this. And it's like, well, it used to be worse.
Yeah, but at least it was Christopher Lee.
Hashtag
nostalgia.
In vivid red. Have you ever seen any of these? I haven't seen these ones, these particular ones.
No.
I've seen some of the Dracula ones, but...
Well, the thing is, I mean, I'm happy that we're ending on Frankenstein. We could also discuss The Mummy and The Werewolf, of course, but from Universal...
Dracula, we've done Zombie.
Yeah. On a sort of ranking level here. Take a sip of water, Laura, please. If you would consider all these iconic monsters.
Fuck, Mary Kill.
Excuse me?
No. I mean, obviously...
Are we doing Fuck, Mary Kill with these monsters?
I wasn't planning on it, but if Elliot wants it,
yeah,
he's
but
the
then,
boss.
Then Laura is raising Jacob Elordi, you know?
Surprisingly, and I think I've mentioned this on the podcast before, I'm not that into Jacob Elordi.
But newsflash, Jacob Elordi is tall. Into you. is tall. No, wait, but okay. So
you were going to ask.
I know. I wonder, like, if you think about what these iconic monsters mean and what they mean to you, and what they portray, maybe in a broader sense. When we discussed zombies, I said I don't really like the idea of zombies. They're dumb. They're dumb dumbs, as you said in that episode. Listen to that episode on your Spotify or Apple. Well, rather on Apple Podcast. Also not on Apple Podcast. Don't listen to it anywhere because everything is bad now. We can't have nice things. Anyway, so Frankenstein falls like a bit in between those. He is dumb dumb, but he becomes more smart. Yeah, and there's way more sort of emotional trajectory and evolution in his character, in the character, way more interesting.
So he kind of goes from a zombie to a Dracula, kind of, because
right.
For those who don't know, like, Frankenstein actually gets real smart because he kind of like meets this blind man and he teaches him how to like read, and he becomes incredibly intellectual and well-spoken, and by the end of it, he's like, hella smart.
is it maybe telling the story of the black sheep? Is it more that, like, okay, it's a child that comes from a situation of being literally put together, not respected,
against his will,
against
as we were all born against our will,
especially Jacob Elordi. Yeah, is it like the not fostered child that needs to find his own way and learn stuff, but being pushed down constantly, and then sort of, it's an inspirational tale in that sense, I guess.
I think in a big way, it's a story about rejection. I think that's kind of the main. It's about like science and responsibility of what you create, mm-hmm. and then that I think also goes for a child because anyone could just have a child. And then there's the responsibility to care for whatever you created. And on the other end, it's about the rejection. Like, Victor Frankenstein rejects the monster. Monster gets real violent because of that, because mm-hmm. he wasn't before. So yeah, it is a little bit those things. So what does it represent? I think it could represent like bad parenting. Yeah. And getting out of a bad home situation. I don't know.
I'm comparing it to the other monsters. I could see that this is more of a... How do you feel like an outsider? This is more like a...
It's a gotcha story. It's like, you rejected me and I came back and I was hella smart. And look at my luscious black hair and my pearly white teeth. Like, it has a little bit of that where he like...
Frankenstein is part of Rocky Horror Picture Show. If there's one film that we screen often that really always shows you that it's such a... outside a movie is Rocky Horror Picture Show. I don't know. There's this sort of, I don't know.
Probably the next remake of Frankenstein or the next good remake, I think, would be one to do with AI.
I mean, we have a lot of those stories already. We have Ex Machina, we have Her. They're all kind of similar stories. Poor Things, you know, that isn't AI. But I think Blade Runner even, like all of those movies kind of are a new representation of AI or... creating life and then having a responsibility. They have a consciousness. How do we deal with that? What is AI? So I think you make a good point. Like, the next Frankenstein could be AI based. Yeah. But I think there's examples where that has already kind of happened. I think there's a lot of modern interpretations of Frankenstein that you wouldn't immediately think of as Frankenstein interpretations.
There's a line between Frankenstein and the idea of assembling a human or something along those lines with spare parts from somewhere else that clearly ties into robotics, right? Mm-hmm. There are enough robot movies that kind of resemble this thing.
Yeah, or even if we're talking from a scientific standpoint, something like The Fly, where it's, you know, it's not necessarily creation, but it is like, oopsie, science went wrong, and now what do we do about it?
You had to bring up Jeff Goldblum again,
of course,
right?
It's not a Celebrating Cinema episode if I don't bring up Jeff Goldblum or Nicolas Cage. We always immediately delete an episode if I don't mention either of them.
You're like 400 more episodes of this podcast that nobody has ever heard.
Yeah. I'm just out here working.
You're clocking at the podcast factory.
Just clocking in at the podcast factory every day. So before we make it to the 90s, where we had one that I definitely want to talk about, I briefly want to mention some like comedic versions of Frankenstein. So Young Frankenstein, right, by Mel Brooks, where Frankenstein pronounces his name Frankenstein, which I think is very funny. That's from 1974 with Gene Wilder. It's very funny. And then one that I haven't seen, but I saw we have a DVD downstairs at the office, is Frankenhooker, the Frank Hennenlotter one. That's the guy that did Basket Case.
Yeah, straight to video guys who do a night here of movies that are, for good reasons,
straight to video.
Straight to video. Yeah. screened that once here, yeah. I haven't seen that either.
I just want to say Frankenhooker, A Tale of Sluts and Bolts is the subtitle of that, in which a medical student sets out to recreate his decapitated fiance by building a new body made of Manhattan street prostitutes. It features a bunch of exploding hookers, and it's, absolutely.
I'm gonna,
straight to video trash.
I completely respect your summary of this, but I'm going to read the Wikipedia line that says it like this,
sure,
and I'll do it as though it's a trailer for a funny comedy. After his fiancée is decapitated by a lawnmower, medical school dropout Jeffrey Franken attempts to resurrect her by assembling the body parts of prostitutes, unwittingly creating a nymphomaniacal monster.
Wow. I'm clocking in at the Frankenhooker factory because I want to see this shit. But yeah, it's promising because it's by the guy that did Basket Case. And if you haven't seen Basket Case, it's a masterpiece, I'd say.
Yeah, and Brain Damage.
Yeah.
And in the same year, Tim Burton's Edward Scissorhands gets released.
Absolutely. That's totally a Frankenstein-y inspired thing of getting rejected by society and then getting accepted in a way for being different. Cute. But then in 1994, we get the incredible, but not that incredible, Branagh adaptation.
Have you seen Well,
whatever this
you,
is?
You texted me when we came up with this idea to record a podcast about this, and then I thought like, oh, Jesus, yeah, I remember seeing this. But a long time ago, I haven't since rewatched it. I just remember that... Because it's Robert De Niro, right? It's Robert De Niro.
Oh, yeah, it's Robert De Niro.
It's Robert De Niro as Frankenstein, the Frankenstein monster.
The monster.
Let that be clear.
Frankenstein is the doctor. The monster is...
I just remember that because I think Kenneth Branagh is quite up to the task of filming such a film. Even though so this is just what I remember, okay? And you correct me.
I'll let you know. I'll correct.
I remember the casting of Robert De Niro being completely wrong.
Oh, yeah.
And it being way too serious.
Yes and no, because I honestly really enjoyed the fact that it was incredibly serious and every line of dialogue is shouted. And it is one of those like... It's alive! I will have revenge, Dr. Frankenstein! Like, the camera just, like, pans up. So it's super camp. And honestly, I'm going to say something mean because I love being mean. Kenneth Branagh is the Bradley Cooper of the 90s. Kenneth Branagh was the guy who was, like, trying so hard. He's like, I'm going to direct all these movies and I'm going to put myself in the movies and they're all going to be very serious vessels. And
Who is he again?
Oh, come on, Elliot.
Elliot's 12 years old.
I know
you
the
can't
name.
Blame him for not knowing.
He was like the guy snorting the most Shakespeare during the 90s.
So he did a bunch of that. He also did a bunch of those kind of Agatha Christie type of, Poirot.
Oh, yeah, he was the Poirot, yeah.
The Poirot stuff.
Is he in Harry Potter?
Yes, so Kenneth Branagh is in Harry Potter as, I had to look this up because I'm not a Potterhead, Gilderoy Lockhart. So he's like one of those like, I think he's a bad guy. And he looks kind of pompous and he has kind of like the red hair. And yes, so he is in Harry Potter. So your generation will know him as Gilderoy Lockhart.
I didn't realize he was given a chance to direct. So now I understand the Bradley Cooper connection.
Yes, so yes, he's... been directing a lot of movies that he just puts himself in as the lead character. And in this case, I'm not really sure if it works. What I do want to give this movie is the creation scene in this is so metal. Like, it absolutely slaps. It's really, like, steampunky. cool, big, like, practical sets. It's very fun.
Is it just a traditional remake of the book?
It is actually the most faithful to the book of, like, every single adaptation there has been for Frankenstein. So Branagh did that right. But yeah, it's camp as hell. It's super 90s. It's kind of in the same vein of Bram Stoker's Dracula, the Francis Ford Coppola one. It's very over the top. And I miss that type of movie because I feel like in this day and age, we're always worried about being cringe. Mm. And this looks camp right in the eye. So
it's funny that Coppola was originally slated to direct this, having already directed Bram Stoker's Dracula. I love the fact that this is called Mary Shelley's Frankenstein.
Because it's the most, yeah, it's the most loyal to the
start
book.
Of this.
Yeah, Bram Stoker's Dracula, Mary Shelley's. Right, yeah.
You know.
J.K. Rowling's Harry Potter.
Yeah. What's her name's 50 Shades of Grey?
E.L. James?
Don't act like you're grasping at straws.
I met her. I'm going to be here so far. I met her.
I can't remember what I know. Do you remember?
Just also another quick sidebar. I saw the second 50 Shades 3 times in theaters. Do not judge me. It was because the first time I was invited to the official premiere in LA at the Ace Theater. Then I came back. There was a premiere here at Tyshynski. They have free booze and also snacks. And I get to dress up nice. So I went again.
And then
I was poor at the time. And then it was the DVD release, and back in the day, pre-COVID, you would get flown out to New York. I would get flown out to New York. Not everyone, I think, but
everybody
gets flown out to New York to go to the DVD release party.
So, oh, get out.
Yeah.
Do you watch it on DVD at a cinema, or what is...
Interesting question. It was just at a cinema, and it was just like, yay, it's coming out on DVD. And they did a big event with all, I'm assuming, male prostitutes.
And you met her every time at each of the premieres? Or
no, only at the DVD release did I briefly interact with her. And only the first one had Dakota Johnson and that guy.
Jamie Dornan
is his name. Yes, thank you.
The Kenneth Branagh. I just remember being in Mexico when the first one came out. This sounds really weird at the beginning of a story.
We should do a special episode about 50 Shades.
Yeah, we'll do a special episode about 50 Shades Grey. But in Mexico, the movie had a different name, of course, and there it was called 50 Sombras de Grey. And I thought, that's way more sexy than 50 Shades of Grey. Anyway.
I agree.
Back to Bram Stoker's 50 Shades of Grey. It's wild.
As I said, it's the most loyal to the book, and it really has the monster being like chased out of town with pitchforks and torches. And
I am correct in thinking that Robert De Niro doesn't make any sense as the monster,
no,
right?
Absolutely not.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
And it is like looks-wise, I'm saying it's the most loyal to the book, but I think looks-wise he does look a little bit like the Universal monster, that he has like a square head and he has like different stitches. But I think, as I mentioned before, the most accurate look of the monster.
Does he have the screws? No, right?
No, he doesn't have screws. No. It's more realistic. It's more just like someone who just like really has a lot of scars in his face. And he has like a crooked nose. Yeah. And I don't know. I don't really like him in this movie. But I thought the vibe of it with all the practical sets and stuff was actually pretty fun. Pretty cool. Then that kind of brings us to the Guillermo del Toro one, which came out in October last year. Did you see this one? You're going to have to watch it now because it's nominated for 9 bloody Oscars.
No, I have not seen it. Actually, due to the fact that usually with Netflix releases, it's a bit of a pickle because, yeah, I'm not gonna get into that, but they're not very preferable to screen because they are...
short
put
windows.
To the windows are really short, so they come out on streaming. So sometimes I pass on them to screen them here. But that also means that I don't get invited to the pre-screenings. Right. So then I need to watch it on Netflix later on or at the cinema.
And you don't have the attention span to watch things.
I know I'll be doing the dishes, as with Mank by David Fincher. People who listen to the podcast know that this is a deep cut. I do the dishes when I watch films on Netflix.
I watched Arrival at the gym.
But...
is that true?
What the fuck did you just say?
Not the first time. Not the first time.
Of all films.
I just love that. I just love that movie. So like when I go to the gym, I either like watch Sex and the City or something dumb. We also did an episode about Sex and the City, by the way. But I was like, I really feel like watching Arrival. What if I drag myself to the gym, watch it on my phone?
What exercising?
Are you firing me?
Yeah. What are you exercising whilst watching Arrival?
I'm on the treadmill. So I go on the treadmill. I put it at a 12% incline. Well, I'm just saying, there's all kinds of ways to enjoy cinema, and one of them is on the treadmill.
There's all kinds of ways to enjoy on an incline or a treadmill. What are we doing here?
Tom, I have a suggestion.
You go to the gym.
Abandon everything you're doing at lab, turn it into a gym with treadmills, put Arrival
on an incline. Put the screen at an incline. Yeah.
People look up.
Treadmill cinema.
Yeah. Honestly, if we could like have one of the small rooms be like six treadmills instead. I'd show up.
With 50 Shades of Grey on.
Chariots of Fire, and then people just... dun, dun,
dun, dun, dun. That's nice. Yes, we should do that.
I am not the one derailing this episode. This will be saved. You are the one on an incline. Anyway.
Guillermo del Toro. I had also...
Okay, this is going to be a weird hot take from somebody who needs to watch films... as a profession, and then do something with it. Everybody that I know who saw this film really, really didn't necessarily hate it, but thought it just was so incredibly meh, which, with all due respect to Netflix, not really now, happens quite often with Netflix movies. A lot of them are like sixes. When coming up to this episode, I thought, like, do I need to watch it then now to be prepared for this? I think there might be a chance I will never see this film.
So what's your hot take?
I will not be watching this film. I'm unsure if I would care.
I only watched it a couple weeks ago because it was nominated for 9 Oscars, as I mentioned. Uh-huh. And I always make myself watch all of the main, like, Best Picture nominees and... also, if things are nominated multiple times, I'll also watch it. Sat down, watched it, had quite a hard time with it. I'm not really a Guillermo del Toro person in general. I think his aesthetic is kind of off-putting. And then also what this movie really does that bothers me is that it just, like, it spells it out for you. He has a conversation with his little brother, who's a bit older in this movie, and he goes, "You know what, Victor Frankenstein? You're the monster." And it's like, slow clap. It's like, wow, you really deducted that from the source material that he's the monster? And it's like, you know that meme, the Garth Marenghi meme? That's like, I know writers that use subtext and they're cowards.
Anyway. This lady explains a meme on a podcast.
I'm so sorry. Again, I really feel like Elliot's looking at me in a way that he's going to fire me. But
Elliot, do you have any idea what she's talking about?
No. Nope.
I have the idea that I am too old for that meme and you are too young.
Okay, so then I have another recommendation for the both of you and the people at home. Garth Marenghi's Dark Place is a really fun comedy show that's like short episodes, very funny. Anyway.
Also watchable at the gym.
Yeah, for people
also,
with short attention spans.
At the gym.
Watch it
on
TikTok.
An incline. But yeah, one thing I have to give to this movie is the creature design is accurate, and I think also the Frankenstein's journey is accurate. One other thing that bothered me about Guillermo del Toro's Frankenstein was how they did the framing device, because it basically starts on this ship, and there's like a Danish captain. The monster shows up, murders about 50 of his crew. Then... Victor Frankenstein, he kind of like storms into the, whatever, the hut, is that what you call it? I'm not a boat person. And the captain goes, "Who are you?" And then this guy sits down, and then it kind of like flashes back to, and he starts talking, and he goes, "Well, when my mother was pregnant, my father told her to eat red meat." And it's like, he starts at the beginning.
It's still Frankenstein we're talking about.
Yes.
Wow, okay.
So in the Guillermo del Toro one, the framing device is that Victor Frankenstein, after the monster kills a bunch of this captain's crew, he sits down to tell the captain his story, which is how it happens in the Kenneth Branagh one, except there he just like looks off and remembers his life instead of going like, so listen, now here's the deal. Back in 1801, my mother was pregnant with my little brother, and like, so
is the at the end of the movie, do you cut back to that scene and the captain is dead? And
worse. Halfway through the movie, are you sitting down? You are. Halfway through the movie, the monster shows up and he goes, wicka, wicka, let me tell my side of the story.
What? No, and is it a different story?
Well, he just...
Is it like Rashomon, but with Frankenstein?
It's kind of like... So Victor Frankenstein kind of tells the story up to the point that he abandons the monster. And it would make sense that Victor Frankenstein wouldn't know what happens after that. So then the monster comes in to this hut on the boat.
But like Deus Ex Machina Frankenstein, he comes in like, oh, by the way, do you want to hear the rest of the story? Here's Frankenstein!
Yeah, tune in next time. So
yeah. the monster of the week, literally.
Jacob Elordi's tall ass walks into this hut and he goes, okay, let me pick it up from here.
You're good.
Tap out.
I have it from here.
So then the second half of the movie is told by the monster.
I remember Victor Frankenstein giving me red meat.
And you know what? It's kind of a fun reveal that... At that point, we don't know that the monster has been, like, learning English and reading a lot of books and stuff. So he comes in and he's like, hey, man, did you know I could talk now? I'm like, so sure. But it just that framing device didn't...
I have a podcast now.
I don't know. I thought that framing device was constantly in the back of my head. It's like everything that happened is like, this poor captain just lost 50 of his friends. And he now has to listen for an hour and a half to this man rambling about his childhood. And that didn't really work for me.
Also, the captain at some point, like, with a Danish accent, kill me now, I can't stand not another perspective of this story, please. Why couldn't have I been killed with the rest of the cast? This is clearly not a Danish accent, by the way, with the rest of the cast.
It's more a bit Werner Herzog-y. Anyway, it doesn't really matter what we think of it, because it has 9 Oscar nominations, Best Picture, Best Supporting Actor for Jacob Elordi, Adapted Screenplay, cinematography, production design, costumes, a lot of below-the-line stuff, costume design, makeup and hairstyling.
Below-the-line stuff. Sorry for the people listening here who are doing production designing, costumes and cinema.
Boo. Best sound and original score for Alexandre Desplat, who's coming to Rotterdam, by the way. So yeah, that brings us to the upcoming release of The Bride. We will be screening that in Lab 111, so do go see it and let us know what you think. Stay connected with us at Celebrating Cinema and Lab by following at Lab111 on Instagram and Letterboxd. Do you love what we do? Support us by leaving a review on your favorite podcast platform. It really helps us climb the ranks of the podcast charts. This was a Lab111 production, edited and produced by Elliot Bloom, and co-produced by myself, Laura Romans. Music comes from Hugo Emmertzahl, and the artwork is by Studio FFF.